Hello everyone, my name is Xavier de Koster and today I'll be talking about continuous integration using Visual Studio and TFS 11 and NuGet. With new editions of these tools lining up and with NuGet being around for some time now, we might take a look at some of the opportunities these tools create in terms of improving our way of continuously integrating our sources. So let me introduce myself properly. My name is Xavier de Koster. I live in Antwerp, Belgium, and I work as a technical consultant for Real Dolmen. I'm also a co-founder of MyGet.org, which is NuGet as a service hosted on Windows Azure. And my main focus lays on application lifecycle management and web technologies, which is really an interesting combination these days. If you want to reach out or have questions after this session, after the Q&A part, don't hesitate to reach out on Twitter. You can find my Twitter handle on the slide. And you can also find me sharing some experiences on my blog, which is also on the slide. So an overview of this session. We'll first go into continuous integration, discuss what it is, why we do this, and try to find some room for improvement. And by doing so, we'll also be dealing with dependencies and some related topics, such as versioning, source control, and maybe their issues as well. And we'll see how we can debug these dependencies. After that, we'll introduce package management to the mix and try to get one step closer to continuous delivery. And by combining these tools and setting up a proper CI process, we'll try to optimize for happiness, both for our customers and our developers. So continuous integration. It must have been in the late 90s when Kent Beck introduced CI. And that's close to 13 years ago. So this should be a practice that is common for everyone. Although it's striking to see that not everyone seems to be continuously integrating their sources in a way they should. So, first of all, a tiny disclaimer here. I'm not saying my way must be your way, for that matter. And I'm not saying that non-optimal is wrong. It all depends on the situation and what you try to accomplish. What I will try to do here is try to point out some opportunities and show you some alternatives to continuous integration and to combine these tools today. So continuous integration. Basically, continuous integration is all about frequently integrating source code and try to detect integration errors as soon as possible. Each integration should be verified by an automated build, and preferably you have some tests as well. So the goal is simple. It's straightforward. We try to detect integration errors, and we try to do that as fast as possible. The reason is obvious. We try to reduce risks, and we try to have a deployable software at any time. So if we look at continuous integration and in our current development environments, we often find the following situation, where a developer commits his sources into source control, a build is triggered, eventually some tests are run, and someone receives the feedback. Now there are a few things there which are not very optimal. For instance, why would we run all tests every single time? I'm sure you've encountered situations where you had some slow running tests or some tests that took way too long, slowing the CI process too much. There's probably also an issue with the feedback loop. I mean, if you always watch or look for the feedback of your CI, you're doing good. But I've seen situations where someone only noticed that the CI failed like 2 days ago. So there's really some room for improvement there. So what happens if compilation fails, which is only one step of the CI process? Well, there's an issue there because your changes are already in source control. And if someone pulls the latest sources or basically gets the latest version, He makes sure his local repository is also in a faulted state, containing those bugs, containing those conflicts. Maybe it doesn't even compile locally as well. So nothing but issues and friction we try to avoid. The same is true actually if a test fails. I mean, he will be able to compile the sources, but the bug is already there. So basically your repository is in a faulted state. And if no one noticed the CI failed, well, I've already told you, you should really try to monitor those CI builds and immediately react on a CI failure. So here's my way of doing CI, and I try to improve this process a bit. And there's a very basic approach into this using gated check-ins, for instance. I try to integrate first, or actually integrate sooner. I won't wait until the sources arrive into my source control system. I really want to integrate before they get there. So if integration fails, I want to make sure that change set is actually rejected. If it succeeds and all goes well, my tests are green, okay, go on and commit these changes. So basically, you end up in a situation where every successful check-in is actually a reward for good work. And there are two more things that you can do to really improve the way you do continuous integration, and that's in the field of testing. So after compilation, you should really have a solid test suite and try to make sure your code is really in a consistent state. And there are two ways to improve this, and one of them is code analysis, which is really trying to enforce some quality standards on your code base. And this can be easily turned on in a build definition by just simply turning on code analysis. The second one is test impact analysis, which is basically analyzing the changes of your commit and detecting which tests are actually impacted by those changes, which is really handy if you want to know, okay, these are the minimum set of tests I need to run before I can commit my sources. Now, in TFS 11, there is a tiny little new checkbox in the build trigger window, and it's one nice one, actually. I'm discussing about gated check-ins here, and there is actually, gated check-ins are not new. There's nothing new about that. It's already existing. But the reason why many teams are not using gated check-ins today is because it's quite resource consuming, actually. If you have like six teams, each six developers, that's 36 potential check-ins, which happen quite often a day. So if you continuously trigger builds based on each check-in, you might end up with a non-optimal resource allocation. So by using this new checkbox, you can simply merge and build up to a certain amount of submissions at once, and check in the resulting merge result at once. So this allows for better resource allocation while still using and benefiting from gated check-ins. Another nice new improvement in TFS 11 is the fact that both the command line runner, the Visual Studio Unit Test Explorer, and Team Build are sharing a common Visual Studio Unit Test platform. And this allows for having out-of-the-box support for not only MS Test, but also for third-party unit test frameworks like NUnit, XUnit, QUnit, and maybe many more to come. So, for instance, XUnit and NUnit already can be tested today. You can find the links on the slide, so you can play around with it already. Now, if you're not a fan of gated check-ins and you want to make sure that you don't have a source control repository which has some tests failing, for instance, there's a new checkbox available in the unit test settings menu in Visual Studio. And you can simply turn it on by clicking on Run Tests After Build. And this will ensure that every developer that builds his solution also will run all the tests. So before you check in your sources, well, at least I hope you do, you simply compile your solution and make sure it builds, but at the same time you will make sure you don't forget to run all those tests. Another nifty new feature in Visual Studio 11 is a separate code analysis results window. So remember the time where you turned on code analysis rules and you at the same time maybe changed some code and maybe compilation fails, but it was really hard to find where the real compilation error occurred because your error results window was bloated with errors and warnings from code analysis. So now they these errors and warnings end up in their own separate window, which is really a good improvement in my opinion. What is more, you can even filter those results and really just type some text in the search box and go through the list. And also the actions linked to each of those items is no longer hidden. You can see the link visible for each item in the results, so you don't have to right click anymore and discover what's underneath. It's visibly available. Now, in terms of these gated check-ins and tracking any build, actually, there's in the pending changes window, you will see some yellow notification at the top of the window. So if you try to check in some changes and a gated build definition is configured, you will be prompted with the dialog to build your changes. There's no other way to check in your sources anyway. So while the build is queued, you can continuously monitor progress in the pending changes window by just looking at the yellow notification at the top. So you can simply click on the link and see the build status and whatever is in the queue and whatever is happening on the build. So it's really discoverable in this way. Now, in terms of feedback, I'm not sure what happened there, but I'm experiencing a way faster feedback using TFS 11 than I used to be before. You will the developer that is checking in his changes and triggered the gated check-in will be prompted with the dialog results within Visual Studio. So this is nothing new. You can simply unshelf if there is a check-in rejection, or you can simply reconcile your workspace whenever your check-in is accepted. Next to that, you still have the build notifications application, which is running in the system tray. So you can simply configure which builds you want to monitor and which events you want to monitor, and you will receive some toast notifications based on that. Now, what is really nice is in the Team Explorer window in Visual Studio, you will see that there is a lot of improvement in the builds layout, because you can easily see your own recent builds. So you can see in the screenshot there, you have a nice overview of your own recent builds, and you can simply double-click on them to go to the to the diagnostics and to go to the drop location and such. But what is also nice is that you can simply favorite some build definition. So if you have a long list of builds and there's one build definition you often use, but you always have a hard time to find it, you can simply click right-click on it and add it to your favorites, and you will have a simple section where you have all your favorite build definitions together. Now, in addition, there's also a search box in the All Build Definitions section where you can simply type some characters and filter out all the build definitions and see whatever is left over. Now, for the demo, I will be using TFS Online or TFS Team Foundation Services, which is in beta right now. TFS Online is actually TFS in the cloud. It's hosted on Windows Azure as well. And it's providing some nice benefits. Basically for the demo, I didn't have to set up an entire TFS and configure a thing and set up a VM and such. So I simply created a live ID, I logged in, and voila, that's it. So imagine that you don't have to set up and configure TFS yourself anymore and leave that to Microsoft, who is experienced in it, and leave also the internal support and maintenance to it. And you will see that you will end up with a nice cost reduction. And also it allows for some incremental feature upgrades, for instance, which is reducing the time span between upgrades to your TFS infrastructure. Now, for now, TFS Online is only supporting Windows Live ID at this very moment, but they are using Windows Azure Access Control Service. So maybe, who knows, I don't know, but maybe Federation will come as well, so you can simply use your Active Directory and log into it. Now, a little warning here, frustration ahead. We will be dealing with dependencies. Actually, when building software, we always are. There's no way around it. To avoid a situation we know as dependency hell, we'll have to take proper action. And to define dependency hell, Wikipedia has some nice definition here, and I've highlighted some words. Well, first of all, we know the frustration. Whenever we are in dependency, we want to get out of it as soon as possible. But dependency hell originates from dealing with software packages and their dependencies, and also with their versions. So if you look at the graph where we have a simple example of an application with three direct dependencies X, Y, Z, and X and Y have their own dependencies, well, so far so good. I mean, this is a very simple application, three direct dependencies and some indirect dependencies. Now, the issue arises when one of those indirect dependencies has another dependency to one of the other dependencies you already have. So, as long as they are compatible, there's no issue. But as soon as you want to upgrade one of those components, you have to be careful, because you have to be on the lookout for compatibility issues and some proper versioning there as well. And this propagates all the way up until you reach the application itself. So if component U has a different dependency to T than the component Y in this slide, you'll have to make sure they are compatible, or either you can upgrade one of them, or you can get rid of it. Or, well, basically, you know, this is a very simple application where you already have to deal with those dependencies and be careful. So there are a few reactions on this dependency issue, which many of us have been doing in the past years. And one of them is commonly known as reinventing the wheel. Well, the most easy way to get rid of dependency issues is basically getting rid of the dependency. So hence, people start to just taking in the sources and compiling this stuff for their own, or maybe inventing it for their own, and well, you end up with duplication. So what happens with the reuse of components? A second reaction to this is, well, in terms of versioning, well, there is an issue as well, because these versions are often not well thought out, and well, is often driven by marketing people or business people, because there's always like this incentive. Okay, we have a version 1.x, and we'll change something in the UI. We call it version 2, and people will buy it. And well, okay, that's maybe so, but it's not a technical way of dealing with the version. It's actually maybe even breaching a contract between the component producer and the component consumer. Another way is like having a knowledge base article linked to your version, for instance, which is, okay, well, you're giving the developer some information, but you're not giving this information to the consumer, the application which is consuming this component, because I haven't seen any application reading knowledge base articles, for instance. So when did that happen, actually? Did we lose ownership of assembly version? These are two questions we need to think about. There's also some cause and effect going on here. As I said, people are removing dependencies, taking in sources, and referencing these sources because they need them for debugging. At least that's what they think. Well, it's not true, actually, because the only thing you need to debug these things is actually the symbols. One benefit you might have, is if you have the sources and you find a bug, is that you can easily fix it and just recompile the thing, and okay, the bug is resolved. You don't have to wait for anyone to release a new version. Now, that may be true if you do it properly, but it's not always the case. Unless you have these sources isolated, you can do so. If not, and you embed these sources into your project, well, basically, it's an illusion that you can fix it faster, because you can't release it. It's it's bottlenecked because the application itself cannot be released yet. Furthermore, if you want to upgrade that that component, you might end up with merges and some issues there as well, because you changed the code, maybe you fixed the bug and the component creator fixed the bug in another way and stuff like that. So there are some drawbacks. If you reference by release and you use symbols for debugging, you'll have a much cleaner upgrade path. So that's really a benefit you have to take into account. And if this component is an open source component, well, and you find a bug, please report it and maybe do a pull request and fix it for yourself. You're helping everyone out, including yourself. So this is the dilemma of referencing by source versus referencing by release. Now, package management, and well, more specifically, solution level package management, because we're talking about software here and not systems. Package management is something we have been missing for many years in the .NET world, and basically NuGet is trying to answer that question. So NuGet, which is available on nuget.org, also comes with a nice gallery containing already over 5,000 unique packages. So that's really a lot. I never imagined that there were so many open source components available there. And what is more, all these components are now within reach of like two clicks or one simple command inside Visual Studio. So you don't even have to go out there, open a browser, look for something, find the correct download link and read some documentation and such. You simply type some keywords in the search box and you now have an installer within your Visual Studio. So what NuGet improved is basically, in a nice way, is discoverability of these components. And because all these components are delivered as NuGet packages, and they are available from the same source location, you also have a consistent upgrade experience. Now, as a direct benefit, you also have a nicer way of reusing software or reusing components. Instead of trying to build your own stuff, people just simply type some search query into the NuGet gallery and see whatever is available first. And because using NuGet packages is actually using a released component, you're referencing by release as well. Whether those packages contain binaries or source code, it doesn't matter. You're actually referencing a release. And preferably, those packages are also pushed using the symbols, so these symbols end up on symbol source. So you end up with a nice debugging experience as well. So NuGet provides some opportunities here. It's not only for open source components. I mean, if you use your own NuGet server internally or externally hosted, it doesn't matter. If you use your own NuGet package repository, you can also benefit from these improvements. So in terms of dependency management, NuGet plays a nice role there. And it's increasing the reach, discoverability, and visibility of your own packages as well, whether that is externally or internally. So even within your own company, you can make it more visible to your team members that there is a new update available, for instance, or that there is a new component available. Now, in terms of versioning, NuGet supports semantic versioning. If you have never heard about semantic versioning before, I really recommend that you read semver.org. It's really well explained, and you can narrow it down to actually these three version numbers I'll explain you right now. So Semver uses a major, minor, and patch number, so the three first version numbers, actually. And it is highly relying on whatever changes you do in your public API or not. So it's really trying to take a pragmatic approach towards telling your consumer what changes you have done in your new version of your component. So if you have some breaking changes in your public API, you really need to indicate it in the major version number. So if you have a v1.x and you perform some breaking changes in your next version, you will end up with the version 2.0. If you only have backwards compatible changes in your API, like new features, for instance, or API additions, That's basically only a minor change. So you don't change the major version in that case. You increment the minor version number by one, and you reset the patch number to zero. Now, if you are doing a hotfix release and only have some internal changes, like bug fixes and such, which do not affect the public API, you only increment the patch number, so the third version number. Now, in addition to these three numbers, there's also support for pre-release tags, like alpha, beta, release candidate, and so on. Now, the annotation is pretty straightforward, actually. You just amend a dash to the patch number and the tag you want to use. Note that these pre-releases are sorted in alphabetical order. So this means that alpha 2, for instance, will be considered a newer version than alpha 2.1, for instance, which is a bit counterintuitive. So a word of caution there. NuGet supports semantic versioning, but there is one catch. NuGet doesn't support the fourth version number, so the build number, if you are using pre-releases. So if you have like 1.00-rc dot some build number, well, you won't be able to create the package. It doesn't support it. So you have to pick a scheme. Either you use major minor patch and a pre-release tag, either you use major minor patch and a build number. Now, there is a workaround. You can simply use major minor patch and the build number for CI packages, for instance, and push it to another feed, for instance, on MyGet. And whenever you want to actually do a pre-release of one of those CI builds, you simply, well, you remove the build number and you amend a pre-release tag. Now, why is there some difference here between the way NuGet supports semantic versioning and the way Semver has been built? Well, it's actually pretty simple. NuGet 1.6 was the first version of NuGet which was supporting this pre-release information. And at the same time, Semver specification was not yet final. So it was a matter of conflicting releases at the same, well, within the same sprint, you would say. Now, when dealing with dependencies, we often also fight with source control systems. And, well, today's source control systems often contain more than just the sources. We put like documents in there, binaries, tools, some scripts, in addition to our sources. And basically the binaries, which are often our dependencies, are the reason we often struggle with merge conflicts. So if you forget to check out a binary file, for instance, and you replace it locally with a new version and you want to check it in, TFS will give you a nice alert saying you that it didn't detect any changes and it will be reverting your changes locally. So this is some friction we want to get rid of as well. And the reason is because the source control systems do not support binary diffing. In addition to that, let's say you are using Log4Net as your logging framework and you have like 37 team projects and each of them are using Log4Net, then you often end up with 37 copies of that same assemblies in source control. And if you have different versions of it, well, you end up with, well, a factor like two or three of that same amount of assemblies. So you're increasing the repository size exponentially as well, both on the server as well as locally. So there's one opportunity here, and if you're using NuGet for your dependencies, well, basically you're inherently using a NuGet package repository as well. And NuGet supports a package restore feature. If you use that feature, you're basically not committing those packages into source control and well, basically only keeping track of the metadata, like the package's config file and the repository's config file, to tell your build agent, for instance, which version of those packages need to be fetched before building. So this is an opportunity to get rid of those binaries in source control, and it will also decrease the amount of conflicts in merging and binary diffing, and also decrease your repository size. It's also a way of managing your dependencies centrally. And by doing all this, you end up with some more fine-grained packages and fine-grained dependencies, which is also a benefit if you want to have some fast delivery process for your hot fixes, for instance, because you're really working isolated, so you can really push out some isolated releases without having to wait for other parts of the component to be fixed as well. So in or out, that's a question often asked these days. Do we want to keep our packages in source control or not? Well, basically, it's your choice. I mean, I'm not saying which is good or bad. I'm just saying have a strategy. Especially if you are using the no-commit strategy, you have to be careful and think about some other dependencies you're having by doing so. For instance, the dependency to the package source. What happens if the package source goes down? And whether that be NuGet or MyGet or any other NuGet repository, it could even be your own internal NuGet repository, it can and probably will eventually go down once. So you have to mitigate that. And also, what if a package got removed from the repository? NuGet.org no longer supports explicitly removing a package exactly because of that reason, because you don't know as a package producer who is depending on it, or if someone is still depending on it, you don't know. And if you use a no-commit strategy, those packages need to be available at all times because it's not in source control. So there is a workaround for it. You can simply make sure you have some nice backup or some mirroring feature, or simply use a central cache where you have at least a copy of those dependencies. In case of emergency, you can still reference that package source and fall back upon. Now, in my demo, let me switch to desktop. I will show you how you can easily set this up. So let's start with an empty solution and add a new project, a simple class library. Voilà. Okay, we have a simple library here. Let's use some. I will consume this library later on in a console application, so don't mind the code. It will be very, very straightforward. So we have a very simple class we want to distribute. Okay. Now let's say I want to create a NuGet package out of this, and I want to distribute this class for consumption. So what I can do is install a package called NuSpec. Going over the wire now for auto completion. So I will install this package, and it will provide me some extra features in the NuGet package manager console, which will allow me to create a NuGet manifest file, which is needed to create your package. While we are waiting. Okay, there it goes. Okay, so the package got installed and we get some instructions. Okay, we get a new command called install NuSpec. So okay, let's use that because that's what we want. We want to have a NuSpec file in this project, and I also want to enable package build. Okay, let's do that. So as you can see, some XSD files are popping up. These are some NuSpec XSDs, which will provide you with IntelliSense as well. It's taking a bit of time, I don't know why. I guess we have Murphy in the room slowing things down.
Could be.
All right, there we go. So we have our new spec file. And as you can see, it is tokenized. So the version and author, well, this will be filled in automatically based on assembly info file. So let's define a description. So this library will print something useful. Just make sure it is there because description is a required field. And we have a version 1. Okay, this is the initial version. Okay, cool. So now if I build my project, it should also build the package. So let's see what happens. It didn't. Ah, okay, I know why. Because I forgot to enable package restore. Actually, what I'm missing in this package is the NuGet executable, the NuGet command line, and I will use the NuGet package restore feature for that, although I'm not restoring anything because I don't have any references. I will still take benefit of this NuGet exe and these NuGet targets files. So now if I build, I should also see it in the outputs. Okay, we see something more here. It's attempting to build a project and using this new spec file for metadata, so it found it. And it successfully created a package with this version number, so let's take a look there. It also created the symbols package. And that's because the NuGet targets are having a build command here. And it's using the symbol switch. So if you want to do anything custom here, and for instance redirect your output to somewhere else or build in a specific configuration, for instance, you can simply modify this part of the NuGet targets and adjust it to your needs. So all I did in the project file, because the project file has changed, was setting the build package, MS build property, to true. So every project that has this build package to true will also trigger the build command for that project. So if you take a look, there we are. We have our NuGet package, we have our symbols package. So now whenever I build a solution, this package will be created. Now if you want to do this only on a specific configuration, for instance, it's very easy to achieve. Let's edit the project file. Let me switch to some XML markup here. So we see we have this build package, MS build property I was referring to. Let's take this one and this new spec file property, which I used in the install new spec file, and move it to the configuration we want, for instance, the release configuration, and let's put it there. So now, if I save this file and reload my project, I'm still in debug. So let me clear that folder. There we go. If I rebuild, it should not create it. So we can already see in the output it should not be created and it's not there. If I switch to release, it should create the package. And my output confirms it. Let's see if it is actually there. Voila, there you go. So this is a very straightforward and easy way, actually, to automatically create NuGet packages upon every compilation of your project. So during CI, you could do this as well. So you could continuously create NuGet packages based on this. Now, if you want to push this one step further and even push the package to some CI feed, for instance, I would not recommend to do this to a public repository which is available for consumption, but really do this to a dedicated CI repository. Well, there's another command available, which is called enable package push. So if you use that one on this project, It is modifying my project again. It's adding some extensions. So let's see what it did. In these extensions, I can now say, okay, there's a to-do here. I want to say, okay, I want to push it, for instance, to this feed. Let's take a look. I have someone here, feed details. Well, actually, this is the name of my feed. Let me copy that. So let's push it to this MyGet feed, for instance. And let's push the symbols as well. And I need my API key. So everyone look the other side. There you go. Voila, let's do that. That's all there is to it. It's configured now to push. So if I now build, and I am in release mode, so this should work. In addition to these NuGet extension targets, which has been imported into the NuGet targets file, which was already there, I'm also applying some versioning logic. So I'm even automating the version number. So you see it has pushed. Let's take a look. It should be there in my packages. There we go. I already had this one. And now we also have the shared another library, which is there. Now, you see there's something in the versioning number, so I don't want this leading zero here. To fix that, let's take a look in what has been added behind the scenes. So in the .NuGet folder, I am using the MSBuild extension pack. So this got installed by just using the enable package push command. And inside that folder, you will find there's another MSBuild file, which is manipulating the version number. So let's take a look at that one. This is also some sort of XML. And let's use 10 instead. So this is just a placeholder for the number of numbers you want to support in the auto increment. If I now build, I should end up with 1.0.0.2. So it is compiling and packaging and pushing and 1.0.0.2. So it is there. Let's take a look. Voila, there we go. And we can see maybe some caching here. Okay, it's being cached, but it is there. So let's consume that package into another solution. I have a package consumption solution open here, and I want to install a package from this MSDN live MyGet feed. So basically, in order to register this feed, you just go to the package manager package sources section and you just add a link to it, give it a name, and you're good to go. I clicked cancel. So in addition, while we're at it, you can still see that the local cache is also registered. I would really recommend you do so. It's available in your user profile, local app data, /nuget/cache. Use that one as a fallback repository, because every package that you download for the first time will end up in your local cache as well. So whenever you're disconnected, you might have a good chance that you have the package available in your local cache, so we can continue working disconnected. So in my consuming client project here, I want to install a package. and I hit tab for auto-completion because I forgot the name of the package. It should autocomplete within a second. So it's now querying the list of available packages on that feed. There we go. Now, this one is the one I just created. I want to install it. You can also install a specific version if you want. So you can see, okay, I want to have this one. By default, it would have taken that one because that's the latest version. So let's install it. There we go. If I look in my packages config, I have this another library, I have this one. Okay, so I should be able to use it. And my class name was print something. And it has found it. So let's just print something useful. It's a stupid demo, I know, but it's just illustrating what I want to show. So let's put some breakpoints here. So I just referenced the released package. I mean, that package did not contain any PDB files or any sources. I can show you if you don't believe me. So if you take a look at this one, look at what is inside. I'm using NuGet Package Explorer for that. Well, basically, it's just containing this DLL and no debug information whatsoever because this was release build. So I want to be able to step through. I want to really fetch the symbols for this package when I want to debug inside it. So to do so, you go to the options page and you select debugging, symbols, and I've already did that before starting the session just to make sure it worked. If you go on MyGit, for instance, you will see that in the feed details, you will find a tab symbol server, this one, and I will copy that. Well, it's basically there. So by registering this one, enabling it, you will be able to automatically fetch the symbols package when you want to step through. So if I run this thing, I should hit my breakpoints. Okay, so this execute method, this is from the other package. Well, this package is not available. It's really a reference by release. I don't have these symbols, although I can still step through it. I mean, I don't have these sources. It is available there. I'm now in the base class, which was originating from the other package. I will do the same for this one I just installed. You can see I'm writing the code. I can simply step through. I can debug this thing and continue. So you see that you can very easily continuously integrate those NuGet packages. I mean, you can continuously build them, you can push them to a separate location, you can push the symbols, and you can experience a nice debugging experience, all with a minimum of effort, actually. Now, in the previous solution, I didn't show you. You do have IntelliSense in this file because I installed the XSDs in your solution. So you see files is there. If I want to have a file, I can take a file from my bin release, stuff like that. Or I can simply say, okay, fetch me whatever is available there recursively and take the DLLs, put them in the lib folder, for instance. So you have IntelliSense, it's way easier to really manipulate the NuSpec file through the XML. Now, if you want to have a GUI, let's not save that. If you want to use the GUI, you simply use NuGet Package Explorer for that, and you can use the UI. Now, let me switch back to the slides. So, what did we do in this solution? I enabled Package Restore. Basically, if I was consuming some packages, this would be fetched automatically. I wouldn't have to do anything for that. I used the NuGet command line in combination with the NuSpec package, and I used the install NuSpec command and enable package push command to create the NuSpec file, provide me with some IntelliSense, and automatically build the package and push the package, including its symbols, to some remote repository. And I also configured a symbols server to debug it. Now, in terms of resources, if you want to read up on continuous integration and really want to learn the basic principles behind it, I recommend you you go to martinfowler.com, which is one of the founding fathers of it. If you want to learn more about Team Foundation service, you go to tfspreview.com, and the ALM Rangers have recently also published a white paper. So if you download the slides, you can simply click on that link and read the white paper about it. Regarding Visual Studio 11 and TFS 11 beta, simply go to microsoft.com/visualstudio/11 and fetch those tools, play around with it. There's some nice improvements. You can do the demo for yourself as well. If you want to learn more about NuGet, go to nuget.org or read up on the docs. There's also a book, Pro NuGet, and you can install package Pro NuGet to learn about that. If you want to learn more about MyGet, simply go to mygit.org, and SymbolSource also provides some nice private symbols repositories in combination with MyGet, and also has some nice FAQ section in telling you how you can configure your Visual Studio to use SymbolSource as your preferred symbol server. Now, as an added bonus, you all get some nice trial for free, so you can play around with MyGet for a limited amount of time. You will experience the small subscription, and so you can set up your private repository and play around for yourself. So go take a look, check it out.